Okay. So I'll just talk briefly and simply about the Four Noble Truths. Because this is the first teaching that the Buddha gave after he attained enlightenment and he walked from Bodhgaya to Sarnath and then saw his five old companions who he had done the ascetic practices with and taught them the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths forms the basic structure for all the Buddha's teachings. And I think if we have a good understanding of these four, then when we hear different teachings, we know how they fit together and why the Buddha taught them and where they go in this schema. So the Four Noble Truths, the first one is the truth of dukkha, which is sometimes translated as suffering or misery, which is not a very good translation. Okay, so the truth of suffering, truth of the cause or origin of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path that leads to that cessation. So the first two talk about our current state, our present situation, that everything's not wonderful in our life and there are causes for it. And the last two talk about our potential, that there exists a state and a path to that liberated state. So I think the Buddha, it was clear he was very skillful in presenting all four and not just the last two. Because many people come to the Dharma and they want to completely block out their whole experience. Yeah, and I just want to have light and love and bliss. Yeah. Don't tell me about suffering. Don't tell me about anger. Just tell me about, you know, how to get some kind of super duper experience. And so they're looking for the last two noble truths without wanting to look at the first two. And we can't do that because we have to cultivate the proper motivation first for practicing the path which leads to the cessation. If we don't have the proper motivation, which comes from hearing about suffering and the cause of suffering, if we don't have that proper motivation, then we're not really doing a spiritual practice at all. We're just seeking thrills and fun. And I say this because, you know, a lot of people come to the Dharma and the reason, the motivation isn't very clear. Yeah, especially, you know, coming to Tibetan Dharma, where, as you see here, there's so much pomp and ceremony and color and, you know, exotica, and people are just attracted towards that. And yet, the whole purpose of all of that is to free us of suffering. But some people don't realize that, and they just want the thrill of, you know, oh, isn't this interesting? Look, there's so much exciting stuff in Tibetan Buddhism. Yeah. So I think facing the problems in our life and their causes is very important, so that we cultivate a sincere Dharma motivation. And then if we have that, our practice will go well, and we'll be able to have a sustained practice. You know, the whole thing depends on the motivation, because if our motivation isn't strong, then after a while we give up the practice even. Okay, so when the Buddha talked about suffering, dukkha is not really translated, suffering is not a good translation for dukkha. Okay, because in English when we say suffering, we think my stomach hurts. Yeah, or I'm depressed. Well, yes, that's one level of dukkha, but it's not really what dukkha's all about, because even animals don't like the suffering of a stomach ache. So, you know, renouncing stomach aches is not what renouncing dukkha is about. Okay? So dukkha means more like unsatisfactory experiences, the fact that everything isn't completely wonderful in our life. Because, and it's important to understand that, because if we just think of suffering on a gross level, then we say, well, What did the Buddha mean when he said life is suffering? Life isn't all suffering. It's beautiful weather out. I'm with my friends. We just had a good meal. What's suffering? Okay? So, you know, that the ouch kind of suffering is not the all that there is to the First Noble Truth. Yeah? So it's a much deeper kind of thing. It's the unsatisfactory nature within which we live. So often they talk about three kinds of suffering, three kinds of ways in which things are unsatisfactory. So the first one is gross suffering. That's the ouch suffering. My stomach hurts, my feelings hurt, I'm depressed, you know, I didn't get what I wanted, whatever it is, okay? It's a gross kind of suffering. So even animals renounce that, okay? No big deal not wanting that kind of suffering. All sentient beings are like that. The second kind of suffering is called changeable suffering. What it means is that things that initially bring us happiness are actually in the nature of suffering. And if we continue to do them long enough, they turn into the gross kind of suffering. Okay? Like we just had this wonderful meal. So at the beginning of the meal, there's a little bit of the gross suffering of hunger. Then we start to eat. Oh, it tastes so good. These mushrooms. This is very good. So then we have what we call happiness. And we think that the happiness is there in the food. But then, if we had kept on eating, eventually, that feeling of happiness would have become suffering because our stomach would have hurt. Okay? So what it shows is that the act of eating itself doesn't bring happiness, or the kind of happiness that we got from eating is not a stable kind of happiness. Because if it were, then the more we ate, the happier we would be. But at a certain level, the more we eat, the more miserable we become. So that's a very gross example of how what we call happiness changes into suffering. There's many situations like this in our life that I think is very important to contemplate clearly, because, again, if we don't have a good insight into this, we can very easily get taken away by attachment to this kind of worldly happiness. Okay? So, for example, you know, when we're young, we feel like, oh, I'm always under my parents' control and I don't have so much money. I can't wait until I grow up and then I can have my own money and I can do what I want and I don't have to listen to my parents. And that's freedom. That's happiness. So, you know, when you turn 18 or whatever it is, and, you know, then you start out and you do that and, you know, I'm going to get an education and I get my job and you start having an income and you start going and doing whatever you want. And you feel so good and proud of yourself. I'm a success. And then you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and your job gets boring and it becomes a rut, and then you're dissatisfied with how much you earn, and you have your freedom and you go here and you go there and you do this and you do that, and you still feel dissatisfied, okay? So what it's showing, again, is that that initial feeling of happiness that we think came from the side of that behavior, that activity, isn't real happiness, because if we keep doing it, we become more and more miserable, okay? Like the people who get a promotion, and at the beginning, it's great because now I have new status in the company and now my family thinks I'm very big. But in the end, that job just becomes, you know, so dreary because they have to work so many hours of overtime and their boss criticizes them and there's all these new problems that come. Okay? Same thing with relationships, you know. We get lonely, so there's the suffering of loneliness, and we think, oh, if only there was some really, you know, wonderful man I could be with, and, you know, da, 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 you know, especially, you know, Dharma man, yeah, not just ordinary man, but a man, you know. One of the women in DFF calls him Buddha boy, okay. Yeah, so we dream, oh, Buddha boy is going to come and have this wonderful relationship, and you know, he understands me, and you know, we develop this Dharma practice together. And then it starts out like that, and then after a while, you know, you quarrel, and he wants to get up and meditate early, and you want to sleep, or you want to get up and meditate early, and he wants to sleep, and or he wants to practice one practice, and you want to do another practice. And then, you know, this thing that you thought was like going to be top-notch superior turns out not to be. Okay? I just had a situation with one of my students who had taken a vow of celibacy. And then he met this woman, and like, without even consulting me, he gave back his vow of celibacy, and you know, and the whole thing, because, and, you know, because she's in the Dharma, and we sit and we do our mantra together before we talk, and you know, so it feels good now, but I'm sure in a couple of months he's going to be writing me about how they quarrel and everything else, yeah. So the thing is, you know, what the second kind of suffering is, that what appears to be happiness is not in the nature of happiness. Because if we keep on with the same thing, be it the job or the relationship or eating or whatever it is, eventually it becomes the cause of this gross suffering. So renouncing that kind of, that level of suffering, the changeable suffering, that's also done by people of other religions. You know, Christian monastics, Hindu swamis, you know, a lot of these people, they see that in worldly things there's no ultimate happiness, and they want to renounce that. So it's a step up from the first suffering, which was renounced also by animals, you know, but it's not a complete kind of renunciation. Because the complete renunciation includes the third suffering, which is called pervasive compounded suffering. And that means that just the fact of having a body and mind that are under the influence of our disturbing attitudes and negative emotions and our karma, just that fact, just being in that situation, is something that produces misery eventually, is something that's unsatisfactory at the end of the day. Why? Because just, we may not even be feeling suffering now, or we may not be, you know, flipped out on some kind of extravaganza happiness right now, the second kind of suffering. But just even we're having a neutral feeling right now, that neutral feeling with the slightest little thing changes into gross suffering. Yeah? I mean, what's a very interesting situations like what happened in America with the, you know, September 11th. It's like, okay, America's happiness. Yeah? But the basis for tremendous suffering was there in the situation, but nobody saw it. And everybody just remained complacent. Oh, our country's so wonderful. Things are so nice here. Then, like this, you know? Within a half an hour of three planes crashing into major buildings, the whole country changes. So it's kind of like that with this third suffering, that even you're in a neutral state, slightest little thing like that, and we're in gross suffering. Isn't it? You know, all we need to do is walk outside, step on some broken glass, we're suffering. Or somebody comes in the room and calls us a name, and we suffer. Huh? So the fact that all this happens is because we're under the influence of ignorance, all of the other disturbing attitudes and negative emotions and karma. So as long as we're under their influence, there's no way we can ever have a state of lasting happiness, because they are the causes and conditions for more and more unhappiness. So it's only when we see this pervasive compounded suffering and renounce that, that we're really doing something that is uniquely Buddhist. Because, Yeah? You see people who will do meditation, you know, great meditation, developing incredible states of single-pointedness. And they've renounced the first two kinds of suffering, the out-suffering and the changeable suffering. And they get into these experiences of single-pointedness, and it's incredibly blissful. So I'm told, I've never experienced it, but they say it's so blissful. And then you can get stuck in those blissful states and even create the karma to be born in one of the form realm concentrations or formless realm concentrations. Stay there for eons, but when that karma finishes, then the only place you have to go is down into the realms of grosser suffering. And so the reason why those meditators get stuck in those upper realms is that they haven't renounced this third kind of suffering of being under the influence of disturbing attitudes and karma. Okay? They've just renounced, ouch, they've renounced worldly pleasure. But they haven't seen that the cause of all of that is the ignorance, and they haven't renounced the ignorance and the whole state of being under the influence of the ignorance and karma. Okay? So, you know, many get stuck in these blissful realms of meditation and concentration. And you can even see, you know, Dharma practitioners too, who, you know, we come into the Dharma and, you know, one part of us, it's like, yeah, I want Dharma happiness, but I also want worldly happiness. And I'm going to practice the Dharma as long as I feel good. And as soon as Dharma stops making me feel good, I'm going to stop practicing it. You know, when I'm confused and I have all these emotional problems, then I meet the Dharma and the Dharma solves my problems and it's so helpful. And now I feel good again. And so no need to practice the Dharma. And they give up. Now you see this all the time. Yeah? Or come into the Dharma and, you know, you have some gross suffering, a relative died, and you're trying to make sense of it. And you come in and the Dharma helps you do that. And then you start doing some meditation and you have like these really wonderful experiences, you know, maybe doing Vajrasattva meditation and experiencing bliss with the nectar into you. And then, you know, then after a while, all that bliss in your meditation goes away and you just have to look at how angry you are. And then it's like, ooh, this practice isn't so interesting anymore. I like doing Vajrasattva when I did it and it filled me up with bliss and I felt so good. But now I don't want to look at my anger. This practice is causing my anger. I better stop doing Vajrasattva because it's making me angry. It's so many people, you know, and then they just stop practice. And the whole reason is because, you know, the motivation has not been very clear. It's been renouncing the ouch kind of suffering and a little bit the second kind of suffering, but not even that one completely, and definitely not the third kind of suffering. You know, because if we really understand what being in samsara means, what it means to have a body and mind that is under the influence of ignorance and karma, if we really understood that, then our Dharma motivation would never flag, it would never become dormant. Because until we're liberated from that, then we see that there's no kind of plateau or resting place. So it's very, very important. And I see more and more, you know, in my years of being in the Dharma, how important, you know, understanding suffering is to gain the proper motivation, and how important the proper motivation is to be able to do sustained practice. Yeah? And since sustained practice is the whole key to realizations, then, you know, gotta do it this way. Okay, so that's a little bit about the first noble truth, suffering or dukkha.